Willkommen bei Context TV. Unser Gast hier in
Welcome to Context TV. Our guest per video stream is Richard D. Wolff, renowned economist and professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. His last book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Welcome back to Context TV, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
More and more social scientists are speaking of a structural crisis of capitalism, and some even about its possible end in the near future. What is your take on this? Is there a structural or even terminal crisis of capitalism, and if so, why?
Yeah, I am never one to be very interested in predictions. So the truth of it is, I don't know whether capitalism is at its end, and I don't think anybody else does either. And usually the ending is something we become very clear about years after it happens. So I don't know about the end of capitalism. But I will say that this is the worst condition of global capitalism in my lifetime. And I've been here a long time. And I will tell you a story. Because I went to the elite universities of the United States, I know many of the leading economists in the United States, right wing, left wing, and in the middle. And we get together sometimes for coffee or to talk. And we do not agree on how the United States got into this current situation. And we do not agree on what to do about it. But the interesting thing is we agree on the following sentence. This is the worst condition of capitalism in our lifetimes. And I think that's a very significant comment. Well, what are the conditions that people point to? I think there are three. One is the explosive importance of the end of the Soviet Union, of the changes in the People's Republic of China, and in this following way, that it opened to Western capitalism, the capitalism of Western Europe, North America, and Japan, an immense new working class, an immense new hundreds of millions of people able and willing and eager to work as employees of capitalist companies. In a simple way, it changed the balance between the employer class, concentrated industrial power in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, on the one hand, and an increased mass of well-trained, low-paid workers. And all that we have seen, at least in the last half century, has been the working out of this radical, different situation, as the capitalists have made an enormous amount of money, basically by figuring out how to take advantage of this enormous new mass of poor but capable workers. Some capitalists did it by bringing in immigrants, low-wage, desperate immigrants to their home countries. Other capitalists did it in the reverse way, moved their production out of the old centers of capitalism into China, India, Brazil, etc. And this is a major change. And the reason it plunges capitalism into a structural crisis is that while it makes a very small number of people very, very wealthy, because basically they're substituting low-wage workers for higher-wage workers, it also presents itself as a fundamental crisis for the mass of the working class in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, because they are being told, you are going down to the level that the Third World was, because we're moving production into the hands of these third world workers. This has not been planned. This has not been explained to the mass of workers. So they are constantly confronted by a deterioration of the social welfare system, social democracy in Europe, of the old New Deal arrangements in the United States that came out of the 1930s. And so you have a working class very much more agitated, very anxious, very worried. And I think you see that in the movement to the right politically in Germany, the support for Le Pen in France, the anger of the French working class against the Socialist Party because it hasn't helped them, the vote for Mr. Trump here in the United States, the vote for Bernie Sanders for the first time in 50 years, an American politician can take the name socialist and millions of people vote for him. All of these are signs of the failure of this system to manage the transition to extraordinary wealth for the top 5%. The second cultural structural problem is no way to handle the political impact. In other words, if you make a tiny group of people, relatively speaking, 5% or whatever the number is, very, very wealthy, and you plunge the mass of people into a declining, frightening situation, you are going to have political explosion. You have to manage that or else it will defeat you. This is the same problem as going back into the 19th century when you make the transition from agrarian feudalism into industrial capitalism. You're going to destroy many institutions. You're going to create all kinds of upheaval. And capitalism was almost overthrown, whether you look at the revolutions of 1848 or of 1870 or the Paris Commune or the revolutions after World War I. This was a mass of workers disturbed by what was going on who almost got rid of capitalism. You're now facing the other side of that problem. The rich, knowing that the mass of people are angry, have decided to manage the situation by buying the political system, by literally taking it away from any democratic foundation because it's too dangerous for them. But what that does is it makes the mass of people not only have economic problems getting worse, but cannot look to the political system for any kind of solution here. So they try wild things. They vote Brexit, or they vote Trump, or they vote Beppe Grillo, or whatever it is that is maybe something, even if it's strange and odd, that maybe gets them out of a dead end. Last thing, in the places to which capitalism moved, that's China, India, Brazil, there you have again the problems of 19th century European capitalism. It's a new capitalism. It's transforming this society. It is moving hundreds of millions of people off of the land into the cities and industry, and it is driving these people crazy, and they have their own tensions, and it's not clear that the people running those societies can manage it. So whether you are in the areas to which capitalism is gone and is growing, or whether you're in the areas that capitalism is abandoning, you have a level of tension between the controllers and the controlled that makes it impossible to know whether this is going to be a phase or whether it might be a system that can't handle the contradictions it has itself brought into being.
What are the options for the future? Can we return to a golden age? Some people refer to the post-war period of Keynesianism in the West, at least, as a golden era of regulated capitalism. Can we return to such a state, or do we need a systemic alternative? And if so, how could it look like? You refer to socialism, for example, but what can it mean in the 21st century? Given also the historic experience and disasters of the 20th century?
Well, a few minutes ago I said I wouldn't predict, and now I'm going to make a little prediction. I have not been a person who thinks capitalism is collapsing. I haven't been part of that kind of, because I don't believe in this sort of prediction business. But I will tell you that I don't see a way out. I don't see a return to capitalism concentrated in its old centers. I believe Mr. Trump, who has a desire to do that here in the United States, will not succeed in this process. He has too many enemies, which include the business community, which is not going to let him do that, I would guess. Or to put it another way, if he succeeds, the destabilization of Europe and Japan will be staggering. And it will, if he succeeds, it will be at the expense of the rest of the world. And in that way, it has parallels with German history in the 1930s and 40s also. You cannot solve these problems inside. It has effects everywhere else, and it mobilizes the whole world against you. And that's the same risk that the United States faces, and it hasn't learned anything from German history at all. Doesn't even know what that history is. So I am closer to believing than ever in my life that the system has now produced a network of problems that it cannot solve, or at least that I don't see solutions emerging that can begin to manage this level of difficulty. If, again, to use our example in America, if Trump proceeds to, for example, threaten the export economies of India, China, and Brazil, we will be in a situation which in the past in human history has gone from a trade war to a military war, and then all calculations make no difference anyway. So in that sense, I guess I am pessimistic. On the other hand, I do think there is emerging a new direction for those of us who think that the solution is not this or that law or regulation or international agreement, but that we are at a point of systemic crisis, and that therefore the only rational solution is to think about what alternative system could be established that would have a different set of problems that are more manageable than the problems of capitalism, which I don't think are manageable. And here, the left, of which I'm a part, has to be able to be not only critical of capitalism and its dead end, but also of the socialist history out of which we come. And here, I would say as simply as I can, the socialism that comes out of the 19th century and that dominated in the 20th century was in its way very successful, but insufficiently profound. That is, it was a socialism that said the problem with capitalism is private ownership of the means of production and markets, so that what we will have is a new system with public ownership of the means of production and government planning. Public ownership and planning versus private ownership and markets. What that ignored was the organization of the workplace, where each of us goes 5 or 6 days of the week from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. That's where we spend most of our adult lives at work. If you do not transform the workplace, your efforts to transform the rest of society won't work, because they will be held back, they will be undone by the unchanged nature of the workplace. And to be simple about it, I don't think in the Soviet Union, and I don't think in the People's Republic of China, you made the transformation. What would that transformation be? Well, before I tell you, the answer, which I will give you in a minute, is the new direction, is the new system, which I think is where we're going, and which can perhaps solve our problem. The answer is you have to revolutionize the workplace because it wasn't done before. Whatever you think about government ownership or state enterprises or planning, has to be rethought in terms of what it would look like if it were built on the basis of a radically transformed work organization. So here's what it would look like. And here in the United States, we use the term, because it's more comfortable in people's minds, of worker co-op. And what it simply means is every workplace changes. The decisions of the workplace are now to be made democratically. One worker, one vote. And in each enterprise, in a factory, in a store, in an office, the workers collectively decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. This is the democratization of the workplace. It is a radical change in how all workplaces will be organized. It gives every worker the role not only of employee, but also of employer. It destroys the foundation of capitalism, which divides people into a small number of employers and a huge number of employees. It is the end of capitalism in the same way that liberating the slave was the end of the slave economy, of liberating the serf was the end of the feudal economy. Liberating the employee, in this case, by transforming him or her into an employer at the same time, is the end of capitalism and will produce another system. And I think if we bring that to the mass of people suffering in a capitalism, they will see this as a revolution that is about them. It's not about giving some distant government all kinds of authority. It's about transforming their own lives and making the government dependent for the first time on a system of democratic control at the base so that they can have some hope of making it work in their interests rather than the interest of the employer. So for me, I would summarize by saying socialism in the 21st century will be more focused at the micro level of the enterprise than at the macro level of ownership and planning, and that's a necessary rebalancing of the micro and the macro, and therefore corrects what was the limitation of socialism in the 19th and 20th century.
Which role could financial institutions play in such a change? We will have probably another banking crisis in Italy. It's already beginning. And what should people do and what should people demand in order to have a different financial system that works for such a change, call it socialism or call it whatever, that works for the people, financial institutions and a money system that works for the people and not for the few? How could such a system look like and how could it be brought about, for example, in the situation of a new financial crisis?
Well, I think that my first answer would be to remind everybody that in Western capitalist societies, almost all of them have developed by allowing private capitalist enterprises to dominate the financial landscape. That is, private banks, private insurance companies, private, all of that. And that the minute you do that, you are subordinating the monetary system, the financial system, to the profit motive, to the profit imperative that governs all capitalist enterprises. And that is a fundamentally irrational step, because what you're doing is you have a society, every one of whom are dependent on financial relationships, debts, cash, bank accounts, savings, all of the things that make up the financial system, we all depend on it every day. To allow something we all depend on to be managed by people who have a different objective. They are not representatives of all of us. They are people trying to make money out of manipulating. This is a system that was crazy from the first step. So for me, it would be an argument for the mass of people to say, banking is much too important, and insurance are much too important social activities to be left in private hands. The banks, the insurance companies, these should be governmental functions, but with governmental meaning that it has two decision makers, the collective of people who work in that activity, in that bank, in that insurance office, and the public they are to serve. And each of these two has to have a structured relationship to share the responsibility and the power to decide what happens. But no private profit motive, no subgroup of investors who have the right to manipulate all of this to make money. That's out. It is democratically selected representatives of the workers in the institution and the public served by the institution that should co-determine how this system works. And I know from the United States that there's already a majority of Americans who support this.
Since the financial crisis in 2008, the EU and the euro in particular have been facing massive risks of breaking apart. Germany and the Troika are imposing harsh austerity measures on southern Europe, where a whole generation has lost its future with the 50% and more of youth unemployment. Meanwhile, the old most powerful parties, especially the Social Democrats or parts of the Conservatives as well, are imploding in many European countries with right-wing populists filling the vacuum and in some other cases also with new progressive movements or parties coming up. What are the options for Europe in your view, and can there be progressive change in Europe within the framework of the neoliberal EU treaties and the Eurozone?
Well, to answer the last part first, I cannot see how Europeans could proceed without undoing the last 30 years of regime. It's the same here in the United States. We have adjusted here in the United States our institutions, our laws, our political parties to serve a capitalism that is internationalized, globalized, that is presiding over growing inequality on a scale that we have not seen for a century. All the institutions have adjusted to that, which means if you're going to break that pattern, you have to rethink and reorganize all of the institutions. My belief is that this is very much up in the air, whether this will take a leftist form or whether it will take a rightist form. I don't believe the rightists have a solution. They really want to solve the problems of capitalism by all kinds of cultural, social, governmental manipulation. But the problem isn't the social, the cultural, and the governmental. The problem is the economic, and they have no solution for that. They want to do more of the same. You can see that here in the United States very clearly. So ironically, I think the left wing, if it could come up with a coherent plan, has as equal a chance, if not a better chance, to show a way out than the right wing. The problem for us has been, here in the United States, and I suspect it's not so different in Europe, that the left wing has been unable or unwilling to break from its own traditions and chart a new path. The biggest critique I have of the Social Democratic Party and even of the Linke Party is you have to come up with a plan. This is how you, as a left winger, are going to solve these problems. You can't always be reacting to the latest difficulty. You have to teach people that the problem isn't neoliberalism. That's just one kind of capitalism. The problem is capitalism, whether it's the neoliberal kind or the old social democratic kind or the Keynesian kind. These are past, dead. We're not going to solve that. And I think the way to go is what I said before about worker co-ops, about this whole new organization of the workplace, which no right winger says a word about, no right winger endorses, no right winger would dare offend their funding sources. You've got to do that. And here, I would give you two examples of people doing it. And they're surprising because they don't come from social democracy in Europe, where you would have expected it. They come from the United States and Britain, which you would not have expected for all the right reasons. So first, Mr. Corbyn in Britain. If you look at the program of Mr. Corbyn, it is in one respect very radical. He is saying that he is committed, as with his Chancellor of the Exchequer, I believe that's the guy, John Macdonald. He has said that if they come to power, they will pass a law which says that every enterprise in England, if it can stay the way it is, but if it plans to close, or if it plans to sell itself to another, or if it plans to go public by issuing stocks, it cannot do that without first offering to its own employees the opportunity to buy the enterprise and run it as a co-op. And when the question was asked, well, where would the workers get the money? Mr. Corbyn smiled and said, the government will lend it to them. That is extraordinary. That is charting a way forward. It's saying we as a political party are committed to build a co-op sector of this economy that is large, that will have lots of support, lots of people. Whoa! The second one is Bernie Sanders. He didn't go as far as Corbyn, not at all. But he did have in his program, if you looked at it, his economic program, co-ops. He was willing to begin, very cautious, not much specifics, but the beginning. And I think that's where they'll figure out, and of course we're trying to push them, but they'll figure out that this is the way to become unique and to begin to be a party with an answer, which is what people are looking for. And I can assure you that what we saw here in the United States, you will see elsewhere. For the first time in American history, for half a century, a man calling himself socialist, who talks against big business, who talks in favor of worker co-ops, got 13 million votes in this country from all kinds of communities that no one had ever expected to vote for, couldn't imagine, because here we are different from Europe. In the United States, socialism, communism, anarchism, terrorism are all the same from the mass of people. We thought that, but we were wrong, because a socialist stood up and said, no, I'm something else, and it turns out, particularly people younger than 35, he gets the majority. If the vote was only people 35 and younger, he'd be the president. So you'd have to now begin to build on what that tells us.
Yeah, last question to Bernie Sanders. I mean, he raised a remarkable number of people and there was a lot of engagement. How do you see the future of the movement now, after the election of Donald Trump? He's still part of, in a way, of the Democratic Party, although he is an independent. He has created an organization also. What do you think? How should the people who were engaged before the elections should engage now in order to make change happen?
Well, that is the issue being fought out here in the United States right now. The biggest criticism from the left of Bernie Sanders is precisely that he stays in the Democratic Party. The biggest counter-argument that comes from him is that American politics is so set up that if he didn't stay in the Democratic Party, he wouldn't get the attention to what his criticisms are, he wouldn't get the audience, he wouldn't get the opportunity. So that at least for the time being, he has to stay in the Democratic Party. My response is we need him in the party and we need him out. Since we can't have him both, let him stay in the Democratic Party and be the left-wing voice. And if I can borrow from the German example, perhaps Mr. Sanders' role would be a little bit like Oscar Lafontaine. Maybe his job is to stay in the Democratic Party until those of us that are outside of the Democratic Party can have something big enough, strong enough, vibrant enough for him to say goodbye to the Democratic Party, and we can merge that which is to the left with the left wing of the old Democratic Party and develop our version of the Die Linke Party. That may be how this proceeds. But I wouldn't say don't do it in the Democratic Party, because the reasons to agitate there remain. But that for the same reason, I would strongly support people working outside of the Democratic Party, critical of the Democratic Party, because for an awful lot, particularly of younger people, the Republican and Democratic parties are the old, dishonored, disrespected leftover of a society they don't like, that they don't support, and that they don't want. If you didn't have something outside of the Democratic Party, these people would turn away from political activity, and they were only brought in by Bernie Sanders, just like Jeremy Corbyn brought in 500,000 British people into the Labour Party. That has to be dealt with as a serious proposition. If the Labour Party succeeds in pushing Corbyn and his supporters out, they will form a new party. If the Democratic Party pushes Bernie out, same thing, which is why they don't do it. They're terribly afraid that they will begin to go down like the Social Democratic Party in Germany, which I believe is what will happen. Mr. Trump understood that by championing working class interests, by keeping jobs from leaving, by destroying Mexico, which is an insane political decision, the United States is going to have a failed state right on its border with millions and millions of desperate people. If Mr. Trump proceeds and it actually works, which I don't think it will, but if it did, it will produce such a disaster in Mexico that will be our politics for the next 40 years. So Americans know all of this, and I think the Democratic Party is in extreme difficulty now, not knowing what to do or how to move in this situation, and this is their own fault. They had opportunity when Obama was elected. They could have tried to do something. They didn't. And that's because they are part of this system and they can't think like that. And this is now going to cost them very big. That's why this election happened, and that's why our politics in the next year or two is going to be, from the European point of view, extremely strange and dangerous.